The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you. Thank you all very, very much. And since we're Mika's book in great part honors women who balance so many different things and juggle their lives and keep their values intact, I think I want to ask you to say hello to someone who has done that spectacularly well throughout the last almost four decades with me and three decades with our son Jesse, our First Lady Midge Randell. Just like all of you, I wake up in the morning and I tune in Channel 28. Now, Channel 28 is Harrisburg Cable, but it's MSNBC. And I tune in Channel 28 because I think what Mika and Joe have done is pretty extraordinary. I don't know how many of you heard the comments I made at a press conference I had in Harrisburg 2 weeks ago. It was on PCN. If you watch PCN, you need to get a life immediately. The only value to watching PCN is I defy you to stay awake while you watch PCN. In fact, I have had the experience of watching myself and falling asleep to myself on TV. Well, on PCN at this press conference, I said in the 33 years that I've been in elective office, politics has changed. And it's changed for the worse. And it makes me fear for our survival as a country. It's become a bitter, partisan, divided business. The bitterness and the partisanship is unbelievable. And that's true in Washington, D.C. It's true in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Sacramento, and Albany, and all across the country. And the ideological posturing is also something that's ripping us apart. If I told the legislature that I had a cure for cancer and I needed $100,000 and we could begin disseminating that cure tomorrow, it would pass, but I'd get 30% of the votes against it. Why? Because people have taken a pledge that under no circumstances, anywhere, anyhow, are they going to raise revenue. We've become a divided, polarized nation. And politicians are first and foremost to blame for it because too few of us have the guts to step in and try to bring it back together. But I think the media shares some of the blame. 24-hour news cycles, cable TV, shouting at each other, wanting controversy, wanting people to get at each other's throats, looking for the sensational, not intelligent discussion of issues. And that's what Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough have been so important to us. We have an intelligent talk show that doesn't try to capsulize important issues in three-minute bites, but devotes 10, 15 minutes to an important issue. We have a show that puts on people from both sides of the spectrum to air their views without having it be like the gladiators versus the lions. We have a show where the two hosts have their own strong opinions, but we have a sensible conservative and a rational progressive. Isn't that refreshing? And they're great people. This book tonight, and Joe and Mika are going to talk about a lot of things, but if you haven't read the book yet, you should buy it and read it because it is a sensational book on three accounts. One, it's a sensational book because of the insights it gives into a career woman trying to do so much, trying to balance the needs of her family with her desire to succeed. It's an incredible look, and it's gut-wrenching and heart-wrenching, an incredible look at that struggle. And I know so many of you in the audience have undertaken that struggle yourself. The second reason it's an incredible book is it's an incredible inside glimpse at the TV news business, which I don't think most of us understand, even someone who goes on TV as much as I didn't understand as much about the business as is revealed in this book. And third, it talks about what price success. And there are times in the book when Mika says, to get there, to do what the network executives wanted me to do, it just wasn't me. And I decided it just wasn't worth it. If I was going to do it, if I was going to succeed, I wanted to succeed being myself. So this is an incredible book. It's an easy read. It's fun. It'll make you smile. It'll make you laugh. It'll make you cry. It's just a great book, and I hope you'll all buy it. And now let's give a real Philadelphia welcome. Well, let me refrain. Not a Philadelphia welcome that we would give to the Cowboys, but a real Philadelphia welcome.
Yay, Mika!
Wow. Woo! Thank you, Governor Ed. That was such an honor, really. Thank you so much for coming here tonight, Governor. My goodness, yes. I don't deserve that.
No. You don't.
Okay. But Joe has been kind enough to come on my book tour because I went on his, and he's going to play Oprah tonight.
I am. Let me just say, I'm very excited about this because, you know, Mika would go on my book tour, and we went everywhere. I mean, from Maine down to Miami, and she just had a great time. In fact, she always got to play Oprah, and mm-hmm. she promised me that if she wrote the book, I would get to be Oprah, ask the questions, go out in the audience and let you ask the questions, and also tell you, look under your seats!
No.
Look under! A new car, I swear to God! You can tell it's a Democratic audience. Not one person believes the Republican. They're just staring at me.
Do a show of hands. Let's find out.
And let me tell you, also put us in charge, and we'll cut the deficit and balance the budget. That didn't work out so well, did it?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Well, at least we tried. Oh, wait. No, we didn't. Okay. So why don't we start tonight, Mika, with a question that you always started with in my book tour.
Oh, okay.
Because we always, the answer's always fascinating. How many Republicans do we have
here? Yes, that's what I wanted. Oh.
Got a few. Okay.
Admit it.
How many Democrats? Woo! And how many independents do we have?
That's a great group. There's a great mix.
Well, it's not really a mix. It's more Democratic than Republican, isn't it now?
I love it.
It's a great mix for you. I'm just going to sit down and let you talk.
No.
So we have found, though, and it's the governor really touched on something, Mika, about how partisan politics has gotten. There is great news, though, and that is that people love coming on our show, having adult discussions, and I think most important, except for Barnacle and Buchanan, and but also everywhere we go on these book tours, people want politicians working together. They want grown-ups again in Harrisburg. They want grown-ups again in Washington, D.C. They really do. And I have been praying. I'm dead serious, and I've said this on the air. I hope you haven't heard. I'm trying to get you demoted. I said the Obama White House needs to get somebody who's a grown-up, who knows, as chief of staff, how to bring people together. And there's only one guy that can do that, and that's Governor Rendell.
Mr. Infrastructure himself.
And,
I'd like to see
and
that.
Let me just say, Mrs. Rendell had two words for that. Hell no.
I just think I saw that.
I'm not going to Washington. But, Mika, isn't that, give good news to this audience, because seriously, everywhere we go, people are saying the same thing. Republicans, Democrats, independents, they're sick and tired of what they've seen over the past 20 years. They don't want politics to be a blood sport anymore. They want discussions, mature discussions, and leaders like Governor Rendell who can sit down and work with the other side.
Absolutely. And come on the show and take a little friction, but also have a good time, which is what we do in the morning. And we actually have conversations that last more than 3 minutes, and we actually don't agree all the time. Sometimes Joe surprises me and takes a position on something that surprises me, and vice versa. You can't exactly divide us up by party. We are each human beings that bring different worldviews to the table, and then our guests add to that. And it's that sort of medley that makes the brew that we put together every morning that seems to be bringing audiences like you. We found this on my book tour and on Joe's book tour, a great mix of opinions, intelligent people who are tired of finding out in the morning what lingerie is going to work for next spring and how to cook the perfect salmon. So we found, I think, that perfect balance, and we're sort of challenging Washington to do the same thing, because I think people are really sick of it from both sides. It's not just, you know... It's not just the Republican Party. You can't say that. You just can't. We have to look at our own party, too, and we have to look at the conversation and the games being played.
But how exciting that I am pretty consistently critical of the Obama administration's domestic agenda.
Yes.
I'm actually more supportive of the foreign policy. And yet they email us during the show. And I get it. No, they do. Valerie will email us and say, Joe, you're a little crazy today. You've been drinking too much coffee. You need to listen to Mika a little bit more. She will. And Axelrod, he gave up on me. But Gibbs will still.
No.
But no, we are actually friends with David and Valerie and Robert and everybody there, except for Rom. But nobody's Rom's friend. So... We have a great discussion, and I think, I just got to say, that is such a big change from the Bush White House, where if you were their friend 95% of the time, that made you their enemy not 5% of the time, but 100% of the time. So we've got to get that back, and I think we're moving in the right direction.
You're a great example of this. We had dinner with Valerie Jarrett and David Axelrod and Bill Burton from the White House the other night, a small dinner in Washington, and this is someone who spent months calling the stimulus package a...
I think actually the exact economic terminology was... a steaming pile of garbage.
That was it.
So, yeah.
This White House, and I'll hand it to them, welcomes good, intelligent criticism and questioning.
That wasn't intelligent, but they welcomed it anyway.
It actually was. The language was a little rough around the edges, but we'll take it. We've heard worse. But I have to say, you know, we question everything every day, and we have people on board who question what's going on with the direction of this country. And yet this White House has us doing our show live from the West Lawn, I believe it was. And that is what we're about. And that
is what
we're hoping.
Of course, they had us do the show on the coldest day of the year. It was 4 degrees.
They were trying to kill you.
Now, let's. They were. Let's do it. They knew I was from Florida, that I couldn't stand it. Real quickly, how many people watched the show?
Oh, my.
Oh, my gosh. That's great.
This is amazing.
How many people think we should vote Barnacle off the island?
No.
You got
no,
two
he's
there?
He's adorable. He's my misogynist.
How about... They like Barnacle. What about... Pat Buchanan.
Oh, no. Don't you do that. I love my Pat Buchanan.
Buchanan, he loves doing the show. They all do. They love doing the show. And Buchanan said, for the first time in my life, I walk through the airport and people aren't swearing at me.
It's true.
Swear to God, Joe, if I had you guys in 92, I would have won. So it's a discussion. Now, let me ask you, how many of you have the book with you, Mika's book with you? I've got to say, the governor, I'm so impressed.
Thank you.
You read this book, governor?
Oh, goodness.
Mrs. Rendell, he's not just saying that, right?
This
isn't a gender gap thing.
He
actually read the book.
Aww,
isn't it?
Really,
I mean,
nice.
It was a fascinating book because it was so honest from the first page to the last page. Wasn't it something? I mean, you're going to be shocked when you read this book because Mika starts out with a horrifying story and she's got a lot of criticism because she tells it in such detail and then talks about a controversial choice she made. And then you go all the way to the end, and you're expecting at the end someone to glean the experiences of the rough and tumble of their life and say, and this is how I figured out how to balance my perfect life. No, it's still chaotic at the end of Mika's book. And that's what makes it real.
I think you've made it worse.
And makes it so fascinating. So, Mika, I want to start. let me ask you, why did you decide to write a book that started the way it did and ended the way it did and opened you up for a lot of criticism online from parents' groups, from conservatives, from feminists, basically from everybody?
Yeah. Well,
why did you decide that it was important for you to write a book that would be controversial like this?
Well, there were a couple of things. There was something that was always irritating me about women on television who balance, whether they're in the public eye or actually doing a job like mine, who have this, have these like good housekeeping cover stories, and they, you know, they're perfect kitchens, and they're, it's just not true. It's just not true. They're not telling you the truth. So there's a little bit of a veil I wanted to rip off. Every choice you make in life has consequences, every single one, no matter which one you make. And all of mine have. And some of them have been bad choices. And I talk about it because there are some messages that I do send to when I speak to young women. And Joe and I actually got the idea for the book when I was talking along with Willie to a bunch of NBC interns. And I had done this a few times and gotten a similar reaction from young women where they're listening intently about, you know, how do you grow so high in the career?
It was an amazing moment because Willie and I gave our talk to the women. And because we're idiots, we were like, steal as many of the supplies from the supply room as you can before you go back to college. And then Mika gave her talk, and those young women were leaning forward and just could not believe what they were hearing from you when you actually told them, everybody else is going to say, work as hard as you can, get the corner office, but I'm going to tell you.
Don't forget to have children. Don't forget to get married if that's something that you want as well. There's so many young women who go into the career world today. In fact, pretty much all of them do in this economy. And also with the way we have evolved, it's pretty much a given. If you go to college, you're thinking about a career if you're a woman. There are fewer, far fewer glass ceilings. But the message that a lot of young people are getting is, and then after you develop that career, then you get married and then you have kids. And I like to challenge the thought of maybe trying to do those things together so they interrelate and you grow as a family. Because this job would mean absolutely nothing to me if I didn't have my children to share it with.
Well, and there's also a danger, isn't there, in your personal life, and you tell this story too, because so many women say, I'm going to work hard in my 20s, and then I'm going to get married in my early 30s. And they say, well, wait, I'm going to wait till I'm 35 because I'm really at a great place now. And sometimes it gets pushed to 36, 37, 38. And then you turn 39. You've committed your life to a company. And you get fired.
And I got fired on my 39th birthday.
Happy birthday, says CBS.
And
So CBS fired you on your 39th birthday. Talk about, because this business
is mean.
Is a horrific business for women. It's do we have any TV executives here?
Right.
It's an extraordinarily misogynistic business. Women are treated horrifically, and you were just thrown out in the middle of this. And you even had a top executive at CBS say he thought you looked kind of weird, and he just didn't get your look. So you have these executives making subjective decisions about your life that you have little control over. Why did you decide to fight back and stay in the business?
Well, just two things before that really quick, and that is this book is in no means I'm a victim. They fired me. They thought I was ugly. There's none of that in there. I look at what I could have done, how I could have perhaps transcended this situation, what I could have done differently. But the reality that Joe talks about is true. You can be a journalist in this business. You can be a serious news anchor. You can be a storyteller. You can be a producer. But if you are a woman and you are being brought up within the ranks, you are also a commodity. You're a piece of meat. And chances are you're being sized up and matched up in a physical way. And it gets really ugly. And the things that you might hear about behind the scenes that sound really pretty bad, they're true.
Well, no, they're not. They're not. They're actually worse than that.
Okay.
They're horrific.
But, again, that's really, although I address it, that's not, I don't sit there and whine and complain about it, because I really loved my years at CBS. I loved telling stories and traveling the country and connecting with producers and creating and making television. I'd wanted to do that since I was 14 years old, and I was living my dream, because I had children that I had blended beautifully into the workplace. If I was doing the news on a Sunday night, chances are Carly or Amelia were under the desk, you know, hiding quietly, hopefully. And they worked, they did their homework there. They knew everybody. I took them on shoots with me. Carly got to go to Sesame Street. Amelia got to go on trips with me. And I really thought that between my husband and I, he's also in the business, that we had found this wonderful blending that was a great role model for the girls. And then the problem with it that I discovered, because I knew that this business was tough, I was ready for the firing by the time management had changed, Dan Rather had left, and Katie Couric had been hired. But the thing I didn't think about when I got fired is that my young, impressionable, wonderful children got fired too. And that was the one thing I hadn't prepared for. I was mentally prepared for getting fired as much as you could be, because you know the reality of this business. But I never thought about how it would affect them. And they were so hurt. They hated it. And it made it much worse. And I dove into being at home because I thought that I could perhaps fill up that way. And then what made me feel guilty is that I missed work a lot. And I admit that in this book. And I think women should talk about that. I think we shouldn't be afraid to say that we miss something else besides our children, and that sometimes we need more, maybe to bring to the table for them, whether it's to be a provider at home because you need to bring home money, or if it's because you want to cultivate them and you want to bring something else to the table beyond what you bring to the table in the home. And it doesn't have to be a career. It can be an incredible project you're working on.
But your kids were really excited, though, about having you home to be a stay-at-home mom, right?
No.
But you were good, though, at being a stay-at-home mom, weren't you?
No, not really. No. I was so shocked when I got fired and so sad. I thought, wow, I'm going to have to start spinning. And I was spinning in my mind how I'm going to tell them. So, like a politician, I started spinning it as good news, like, hey, girls, we're going to have much more time together.
No!
And they were like, seriously, I'll never forget the moment in our little townhouse in the living room where they both were moving and just froze. And they were like, what? What? They could feel it. And I said, well, Mommy's going to be leaving CBS News in a few weeks, and I'm going to spend much more time with you. And they were like, Amelia was 11, and she was like, you can't do that. You can't do that. You working at CBS, that's the only reason the library lady likes me. You can't leave CBS. And Carly was really quiet. She was 8. And I remember taking note of that, but I had a lot on my mind, and I was trying to keep the night going, and I thought I'd try and cook something, which was a disaster. And that never got better. But I thought to myself, I will prove to them that I can be a stay-at-home mom, and I will be much more available, and there'll be some real benefits to this. And the next day, the school called. And the teacher, Carly's teacher, called me, which is an event in itself, because she knows to call my husband, because I'm a correspondent for CBS News, and chances are because he works in local, can be automatically reached, and that was the deal we had. So I thought, oh, my God, here's my chance. I'm a stay-at-home mom. I am going to be there. I won't go to work today, since I'm leaving anyway. I'm going to see what's wrong with Carly and show her how available I am and fix the problem. So I go riding in there, and she's sitting on the floor. And this is this story just says so much about today's children. Either that or I need a team of psychiatrists to fix the problem. She was very upset, and I crouched down, and the teacher was with her, and I was like, my God, what happened? What can I do? And the teacher said, Carly told me the news that you're going to be leaving CBS. And I looked at her, I looked at Carly, and I said, well, that's good news, Carly. We're going to, mommy is, it's true, it's not out yet, but we're going to have much more time together, honey. And she is still with her head down. The teacher goes, that's actually the problem. And I'm really confused and also like thinking, oh, this teacher's really like, you know, judging me right now. And Carly looks up and goes, but mommy, I don't want you to leave CBS. And she has tears pouring down her face. She goes, because you love it so much. And she was never telling the truth more in her life than she even knew at that moment. She ripped the veil off the whole thing. She totally, totally busted me. And I realized at that point, actually it was the first time I cried about losing my job, which is totally inappropriate parenting.
So actually the teacher had to deal with your daughter crying with one arm and you crying with the other.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's great.
She's hugging me. Carly's alone.
Good job, mommy.
But, you know, I realized at that point they'd seen me rise to the top. They've got to see me fall to the bottom, and they've got to see me get to the other side of this somehow, some way. And you know what? If I never work again, they've got to see me get through this. This
is ridiculous. And they also shared you interviewing for jobs and
yes.
how heartbreaking that was for you.
It was horrible.
No, seriously, it was a terrible time for you, but they lived through that after having mommy being a rising star at CBS. Suddenly you're out for a year. They
and
prep
no
you
one.
For these interviews, fill out applications, and it was one failure after another. It was a soul-crushing experience, the low point of their life. No, seriously, how important was that? You know, she gives me the questions to ask her, and then she acts shocked when I ask her the questions. And next, talk about the failure that I went through. It'll make the women think you're more sensitive. And then she pulls the rug out from underneath me every night. So talk about that wonderful, idyllic year.
Well.
Trying to get a job.
Yeah, no, actually every interview is tough because when you are a commodity or a piece of meat in the world of television and you've been dumped, that makes you like even, you just, everyone thinks there's something wrong with you. And every interview brought me farther away from where I wanted to go because every interview they asked and would be presidents of the networks and then it'd be the vice president and then it'd be the head of recruiting and then it'd be someone's assistant. And, you know, it was soul-crushing in a professional way. It really was a bummer. And I just didn't interview well at all. It was not the path for me to try and sell myself in a way, especially when I was feeling the way I was. Having said that, I got so worried about finances that I started looking in other fields. And I did come close to a very high-paying job in public relations. And we were getting very close to discussing money, getting beyond an offer. And in the middle of that meeting, I blurted out, I know someone better for the job, because I did. Somebody else who was fired from CBS. And she got the job. But what I realized at that moment is that I need to be in television. It's what I do. It's what I am. And I'm going to have to figure out a way to do this. And I'm going to have to stop listening to agents and looking at what I had, which nobody in this economy should, because no one will get what they had. You're going to have to regroup. And I got to figure out how to get back in. I was just about to turn 40, and I decided to start all over again. And I called MSNBC, where I had worked 10 years before, and I said, what do you have? What jobs do you have? And they said, well, we don't have anything you'd want. I mean, you worked at 60 Minutes. We don't have anything you want. And I said, I don't care about what I might want. I want to know what you have. Can you please pull up the human resources page of employment opportunities and read to me the jobs that you have available? And they said, we have, and they were like laughing when they said it, a freelance day rate job reading news cut-ins at night and sometimes in the middle of the night. But it's not full time. We'd call you when we need you, and it's not that you're not going to get paid that much. And I said, I'll take it. To me, seemed like a really good idea. I had been out of work for a year, and I missed it, and it was time to face that. I needed to work. I love to work. And nothing felt better than walking into MSNBC, even though I'd been in all these great places and grand positions, and just to go beep with a little card and check in somewhere. The function of working was important to me, and it was important to my family. No one was more pleased than Carly, Amelia, and Jim for me to just get out of the house a little bit and not cook dinner.
And if you actually look in the center of the book, Mika and Jim always have these great Christmas cards every year, and they're hilarious. And the one from the year when Mika was out of work was a picture of Mika with a vodka bottle draining it, and her kids holding a sign saying, please find mommy's a job. Get her out of the house.
We learned to laugh.
Oh, did you not put that one in the book?
I wouldn't because of the vodka.
Oh, the vodka. Okay. I told you. She's a lush.
You tell everyone about the vodka.
I do. I do. So we've got a couple of more questions, and I want to open it up. But I want you to tell a story tonight that you couldn't really tell last night, and that's because your mother was in the audience. And it's about how your mother fed Pamela Harriman, ambassador to France, roadkill.
Well, she did. And I told it right before she got in, but then I got nervous and had to wrap it up. Look, we grew up in Washington, and Joe loves to paint a picture of an elitist background with lots of summers and weekends in the south of France. And the book debunks that, just a tad. We were like the Polish hillbillies come to Washington. My parents hunt for their food. They grow their crops. They wear secondhand clothes, and so did we. And we built everything, our fence, our little stable, everything on our property, me, my brothers, and my mother, the carpenter and artist, built with our bare hands, and a chicken house, too. They hunt deer, and they bring them home and hang them off the beech tree after they've gutted them to let them dry out a little bit. And sometimes they bring the deer in the house. Like one winter, when it was my mother was so busy with her art that she didn't have time to gut it, so she put it in a bathtub off the side of the kitchen, closed the door, opened the window, so it was like a little refrigerator. And that way it wouldn't go bad until she had time to gut it. And I was trying to make friends. I was maybe 11, and I brought the coolest girl in school home. Seriously, the boys liked her. She had long legs, blonde hair. Her name was Sarah Height. And I swear I could not believe that Sarah Height was coming over, and I was really, really concerned that things went well. And she asked if she could use the bathroom. And I was like, yeah, it's by the kitchen. And before I could think that something was dreadfully wrong, because I was just like frozen in time, thinking I just did something wrong. I mean, I know something is about to go wrong. I heard this blood-curdling scream. And let me tell you, she was gone. I went and looked. The deer was like, blood coming out of its mouth. The hooves sticking out. It's like it was taking a bath, but dead. So anyhow, with that in mind, my mother doesn't like to waste food, and she'll often pick me up at school, like with her big, she'd pick me up with her big art suit on, which she wore every day and never washed, and have like paint splattered on it, sawdust on it, and sometimes blood, like that. I would know something died. We ate our geese one day; she got sick of them, and I had a black chicken named Rose, who saw her last day on our dinner table. But it's awful. But you don't waste food in our house. And so there was the roadkill, and then we'll open it up to questions. My mom saw a deer that had been freshly hit when she was picking me up from school, and she thought, well, we can't waste that. It's good. That's good fresh meat. So she gets out of her car and starts hacking the thing up. And I knew that something was wrong because she had a lot of blood on her thing. And so I get in the car and I'm like, there's a deer in the back of the car. And she's like, oh, yeah, no, that just got hit. I'm going to serve it Thursday night. Now I don't have to worry about what I'm going to serve because I've got my venison. And we had Pamela Harriman, senators, Washington thought leaders over, and the kids serve, everything is very elegant, and we have my mother's beautiful china from Czechoslovakia. It's a beautiful evening, and people are eating, and they're like, divine, fabulous. Oh, Mushka, who is your caterer? And my mother, like she was saying, oh, I got these shoes at Hex, 50% off. No caterer, I got this on the side of the road. And everybody froze. Pamela Harriman spit it out. And to this day, she has no idea that there was anything wrong with that. And you know what? Growing up, I had so many experiences where I would cringe like that, where I'd just be like, oh, my God. How am I even going to connect with anybody? I mean, these people are weird. But, you know, I went from cringing and embarrassed to, as a woman and a mother and a wife, completely in awe of her ability to focus and to know who she is. And people love her. They say she's crazy, but they love her. And they have become kind of fixtures in Washington. You go to our house, and there will be a story that people have to tell.
And they are, for the record, they are crazy.
Okay. They like you very much.
They do like me very much.
Especially my father.
Your father likes me so much that he says, you are stunningly superficial. In fact, he says that on national television. Oh, even if you didn't see it that morning, I'm sure you saw it on YouTube.
We have...
Or the Huffington Post.
You
or the Daily Kos.
You can't play Oprah. Look, we have...
I know we can't play Oprah. So anyway, okay, well, I'll tell you what. We're going to open it up for your questions. And who has a microphone? Oh, here we go. So I'm going to call on you and then wait till the microphone comes so they can hear you. Right here on the second row, is that a Patriots jersey?
Yeah.
My God, I wouldn't be wearing a Patriots jersey today.
Look at this.
That's it.
Yes.
All right.
Hi, Jim.
All right. Hey.
Hi there.
I'm a big fan of you guys. Watch y'all every morning. I've been watching y'all since my mom started covering the Obama election. This is really for Mika. I have a present for you. I wanted to give you a Snoopy doll.
A what?
A Snoopy doll.
What is that? I'm scared. Oh, Snoopy. I love Snoopy. Thank you. I love Snoopy.
Okay, it's yours.
Is there
some symbolism to this?
Oh, that's so
another one.
Nice.
Okay.
Really? Because I have two girls.
Here you go. I'll catch.
Okay.
There you go. There we go.
Thank you.
That's
the best gift I've ever gotten.
Thank you very much.
I only acted scared because we were on the road once and somebody gave me a bag of trash.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do. It was in Iowa, and I the damnedest thing I ever saw.
So, I'm serious.
Yeah, no. I got them from CVS. They were 90% off after Christmas.
Yeah, all right.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Any other gifts? Yes. Hold on 1 second. Here
question,
we go.
Question,
the microphone.
Are those the Donnie shoes that he...
Yes!
I knew!
Okay.
Do you like them?
They're fabulous.
Aren't they nice? Look
are they Louboutins?
Yeah.
Are they what? What are they?
Louboutins.
Yes! Yes! Okay.
Those aren't too sexy for television. Why couldn't you wear them on TV?
Well, she's worn them on TV before.
Once in a while.
No, those weren't the other shoes that...
Hi, Josh.
That Peggy Noonan called Original Sin on Stilts.
By the way, is Judy London here? Where is she? Hi! My husband says hi.
Okay. So, Donnie Deutsch, of course, gave those because every time he opens his mouth, not only does he insult Mika Brzezinski, he insults every woman in America. So, yes, sir. Right here.
Well, you look great at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you look great now. And I wonder, how much of an interference is that with getting your job done? And how much of a difference is it with you looking great at 6 in the morning and you and Willie looking great? A certain amount of thought goes into all of
you. I thought you were talking to Joe.
Well, actually, I...
No, but
you know, I don't...
Is it still much more difficult for women in your business? Or do you enjoy it? Do you enjoy the shoes and the tight sweaters and all of it?
Oh.
I've actually...
I'll go there.
Well, You know, I actually, if I can answer this, I've actually patented my beauty secret, so I don't like to talk about it. Next question. You know what we found, though, and Hillary Clinton said something during the campaign that I thought was fascinating, Mika?
Yes. I'm listening. It's fascinating.
Remember when Hillary said, it's not fair because I have to wake up an hour earlier than every man I run against?
Yes.
That seriously, that's your life, and that Mika has to wake up at 3:30 and to get ready and do all the things that she has to do to be on TV, because women are judged, dead serious, far more harshly than men. My God, look at me. And there are times, if I'm tired, I can wake up at 5:30, 5:45, throw on a suit, run my hand through my hair, seriously, and be on the set and go. But Mika, it's not that way for you. It is horrific. And the emails?
Yeah.
You were judged so harshly for everything you do. And it's not just you, it's women. Talk about how unfair it is, the different standard.
Well, it is unfair. There is a different standard. Okay. Aren't they cute? Because it's visual business. And, I mean, a lot of it is pretty obvious. And I will say that at 42 years old, I actually did not think I would be, after I got fired, I would find my way back into a job like this. Because this is such a subjective, difficult 3 hours a day of people looking at you and emailing you and telling you you look like hell kind of job. But what we try and do is transcend it. I think Joe has made some choices with this show that go beyond that, and people have responded to it. So do I enjoy it? No. I actually get really depressed, and I find it really hard. And there are days that I see things happening for reasons that have nothing to do with quality of work or ability to communicate or talent, and have everything to do with sort of a visual thing or even kind of a sexualized thing. And I think it's hard. It can be very, very depressing.
And it was very educational for me, because I would, you know, I have a rule now. If you see anything that I do on the internet and you want to get to him and you write a nasty comment, you're wasting your time. I don't read your comments anymore. But I used to read comments, and I'm sure, Governor, you do the same thing. All public figures would read the comments, and I always thought they were so damn nasty. And, of course, you take every insult personally. And then I went on websites and saw what they were saying about Mika. And I'm dead serious. Again, it's not about Mika. It's about her being a woman. And they were the most just sick, repulsive comments in the world. I'm telling you, this has been such an educational process for me, because it's not just TV, it's politics too. Women live by a different standard, a higher standard, an unfair standard. Does she enjoy it? Good God, man. No. Would you? No. It is so much more difficult. You know, it's that Charlie Rich song, and it makes me glad that I'm a man. Because I can wake up at 5:45.
Yeah.
It is so much tougher for women.
Yeah.
By the way, pretty damn good Charlie Rich imitation, huh?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think so.
No, it's all right. It sucked. Nobody knows Charlie Rich is anyway. We're not the Redneck Riviera anymore. Let's go in the back. There's a man in a red sweater, and he's just holding his hand up as high as it can go.
I thought that comment that your father made on that show that time was one of the great moments of unscripted TV.
You mean when he said that I sucked?
I know.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you so
and
much.
Mika, the expression on your face was amazing. Can you share what you said to your father later and what you said to Joe after that? Because I've been dying to ask you ever since I heard that. It was a great moment.
You really liked that moment, didn't you? I could actually send you pictures if you'd like, where my son hit me in the crotch with a baseball bat. Mika can't really tell you what was said because she went under the desk in a fetal position. And you'd been warning me, hadn't you? You
said,
don't let my dad on. I go, no, nah, this would be great. I get along with everybody. Don't bring him on. I can handle it. But actually, he insulted me. She went under the desk, and I think the governor will tell you, you don't take that stuff personally. If you're dealing, it's like about ideas. And he was having fun. He poked at me. I poked back. And we had a great time. Can I tell the rest of the story, though?
Yeah. Well, yes, but I will say that I did feel really bad, and I tried to explain to Joe that that was the way he expresses love. No, it is, and you have come to learn, having gotten to know my parents.
They're really tough on people they love.
But now you may tell the story.
Now, seriously, last night, I kid you not. Well, first of all, Ian, her oldest brother, we're sitting there and we're at a Christmas party and everybody's poking fun at Mika. And so Chris, the EP, Chris Licht and I, and start talking about how we love working with Mika. And she's one of the smartest people we've ever met. She's so driven.
And it's a crowd about
And we're
size.
Just lucky to be in her presence. I mean, because she's the greatest person to work with, hardest working person in the world, so dedicated. And he cut me off and he said, you do know my sister had the lowest SAT score in the history of Williams College. And I said to her afterwards, you're right, your family's really screwed up. So last night, a year later, Mrs. Brzezinski comes to the bookstore, Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C. And we're talking and she comes in. And somebody asks about Mika. And I say, oh, you know, she is so great and blah, blah. I start giving the speech. Mrs. Brzezinski last night stands up and she says, can I say something? And we're like, sure, Mrs. Brzezinski. And they hand her the mic and she says, you know, Mika had the lowest SAT score in the history of Williams College.
So it was loving.
Him saying that to me was a bargain. I will say, though, Mika called me up afterwards. You okay? I said, I'm fine.
I did feel terrible.
She felt horrible. She called me up on Saturday. You doing okay? Because by this time it had gone viral on the internet. I said, I am fine. I got thick skin. I've been in politics. She asked me again on Sunday. So I come in on Monday, and I say, Chris Lick, so what do you weekend okay? And I said, yeah, it was fine. I said, Mika felt really bad. Don't worry about it. I said, listen, she couldn't control her. Felt really, really bad. In fact, I felt bad for her. And Chris said, well, I don't know if I would have felt so bad for her. And I said, why is that? He said, I got a call from a friend who saw Mika on the Acela going from Washington to New York. And she was wearing a T-shirt that had two words on it.
Stunningly superficial. But somebody sent it to me and I was cold.
Yeah.
I'm from a practical family.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. They are a tough family.
Well, all right, we have a good time.
More questions. In the back, yes, sir. Back to the right.
Hello.
Hi.
I want to congratulate y'all on making me late for work every morning watching the show. Congratulations.
You are our audience.
Thank you. Got to have the late to work club.
Work or wait. Yeah, we're talking about having a late for work club because we have so many people telling us.
How many would join?
That we almost got them fired in 2008.
That's
great. Work's overrated.
But I want to touch on one subject. The other morning about the Harry Reid comment.
It's okay.
Or controversy. Oh no, don't run, Joe.
Come on back. Let's go.
I wanted to touch on how you were all over Mika, pardon it, no pun intended, like a tart, about how this president has a history of letting Democrats get away with saying anything and jumping all over Republicans.
Right.
But I have a flip side of that, though.
I'm sure you do.
Okay, here it goes. He forgave Joe You Lie Wilson for screaming You Lie at his State of the Address.
Oh.
One.
Okay.
Two.
Now,
Yeah.
Hmm.
When Rush Limbaugh called him Barack the Magic Negro, that's two. He didn't have to apologize because Rush never apologized. He never had to forgive for that. Three, you had the senator or
you've been taking lessons from Harold Ford. Always three points.
I was screaming at the TV. That's what made me.
Do you get pedicures too? I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
When it was either the senator or the congressman that said that if abortions were funded back when Barack was born, we wouldn't have two of the greatest minds. That would be him and Clarence Thomas. That was really harsh, and he took the high road on it. So there's a story of the president forgiving Republicans.
Well, let me just tell you, please, please, three great points. Let me just tell you that I promised Valerie Jarrett yesterday that I would talk no more about Negro dialect, skin tone, or what was the third thing? Rednecks from Searchlight, Nevada.
Right.
So, listen, I mean, everybody makes mistakes. I think my biggest point, though, everybody was trying to make different arguments about, Harry was saying it this way or Harry was saying it that way. I just said, as a son of the South, I understand about mindsets. That's why in 2002, when everybody else was saying, forgive Trent Lott. I like Trent. I know Trent. But again, it's the mindset. He knew what he was saying. And again, I don't care whether there was malice there or not. I just don't know if we wanted somebody running the United States Senate that had that type of worldview. And I gotta say, Harry Reid sounded an awful lot like a guy in a 1955 Birmingham country club. But since I swore I would never talk about Harry Reid again, I won't. But listen, this president has been gracious. I'm not going to get back into the back and forth. I probably made a mistake by doing that because there's too much finger pointing, and once you start that, it's a never ending. Well, you said this,
that's
and he
fair.
Said that, and la di da di da. Yes, yes.
Wait for. Is there a microphone coming?
What can the two of you do to tamp down the use of airtime to make politics into entertainment, to hours and hours on nothing when so much is going on?
I love that question. I think
what is your role in that? Because you have to... You have to be popular. You have to talk about what people want to talk about.
I don't know. I've gotten by in life being very unpopular in audiences just like this.
No. And you are very popular because you actually are a conservative Republican who's not screaming at the camera and saying, if you don't believe what I believe, then there's something wrong with you. And you are willing to take on three Democrats and hash out an issue. But I will say what can we do is what we're doing, and hopefully much more of it. We do it on the radio, and we try and take the show on the road like this as much as we can with books and for other reasons. But Joe came up with this concept for this show for exactly the reason that you were talking about. First of all, the wasted airtime on news that is not news, that is just garbage. Well, that is us making fun of ourselves and making fun of the media.
You're just talking about news you can't use. And also, Mika, let's go back to the very beginning of the show. We'd already told the news executives that we were going to do the show we wanted to do, and we were going to do foreign policy, and we were going to do pretty hard stuff. And they kept sending us fluff stories. And finally, Mika said enough when they sent her a story talking about Paris Hilton getting out of jail. And she burned it. She shredded it. And that was really, it was a lot of fun. I think you got 4 or 5 million YouTube hits. But it really sent, it sent a strong message.
It did. And it was what we are. You know, we kind of cut through the BS that is out there and try and have a real conversation. But what Joe did, which pushes the envelope here, is create a show where we have thought leaders on, and we talk to them for quite long periods of time. And what we have found is that there is a small but vibrant and very brilliant audience out there for a show like this. And we're the answer, I think, to some of this stuff.
Well, there are two parts of it. I mean, but we knew that we had a great audience when in 2007, I was walking through the airport. I saw Walter Isaacson's new book on Einstein. I picked it up. I read it on the plane. And I told Chris, hey, I want to do a segment with Walter Isaacson on this book about Einstein. And Chris Licht, our executive producer, like, yeah, I don't know if everybody will love that book as much as you, Joe, but that's a great point. Maybe next week. I said, just let's get him on the, he'll be great. Unfortunately, Walter Isaacson doesn't like waking up early, so he said, I'm going to phone it in. Literally, I'm going to do a phoner. I will call you from my bed, half asleep. Chris was like, no. I said, let's just do it. We'll just do it for 5 minutes.
Try it.
So I get Walter on, and 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 13 minutes into it, Chris is yelling into my ear, you're killing me! You're killing me! That sound in your ear is the voice of hundreds of thousands of people changing their TV sets! Get him off! Get him off! So after about 15 minutes, I say, Walter Isaacson, thank you so much for being with us. This is a great book. Hey, I got a great idea. Can you stay with us another segment? And Chris shouts, no! The next day, we get our ratings in, and we looked at it. And those two segments were the highest rated segments of 2007. And at that point, we realized not that we had a special show, but that we had a special audience. And let me just say very quickly, there's a second part of the equation of what we have to do. The first part is what you said, getting news, hard news in there for intelligent people like you all. The second part of it is calling BS on powerful figures on both sides when they act irresponsibly. When Glenn Beck says that Barack Obama is a racist that hates all white people, doesn't matter that I'm a conservative or that I used to be a Republican congressman, I've got to call him out. When Rush Limbaugh says the horrific things that Rush Limbaugh said, I've got to call him out. But there's another side of that, too. Democrats need to start calling people out on their side when they are as extreme as well. You know, this whole healthcare bit series, I was talking to Howard Dean, and we just sat there in amazement after a debate about just, like the governor said, how horrible things have gotten. I said to Howard Dean, I said, you know, Howard, you're a progressive. I'm a small government guy. I bet we could go in a room, and after about 5 hours, we could work out a deal that I could sell to small government conservatives, and you could sell to big government progressives. He said, you're exactly right. Now, there aren't a lot of people that I can say that about, but certainly, and I don't know if the governor would go in a room with me for a couple of hours. Might be bad for your standing in Philly if you admitted it. But I know, Governor, I'm dead serious here, though. I know I could go into a room with a different worldview about what government should do, what its responsibility should be, and we could come out with a set of consumer protections and things that would empower the free market, like getting rid of the antitrust exemption for insurance companies and tort reform for my side and for your side, expanding coverage, even if the federal government's going to expand that coverage through a public option. And I could go to my people and say, you know what? We're going to have the federal government providing insurance through a public option. But guess what? They're going to be competing against 1,300 insurance companies instead of one or two in a state monopoly because the governor gave me the opportunity to tear down the walls that divide Americans state to state to state so we can only choose between one or two. Now, let me ask all Republicans and all Democrats and all independents in that room, if we struck that deal and came to you and said, we're going to have tort reform, we're going to get rid of the antitrust exemption, right? We're going to make sure that you can buy from 1,300 insurance companies instead of two. We're going to expand coverage so it is universal. Would you say, I don't like everything about that, but I'll take it? Well, why can't Washington? I heard somebody say no to tort reform. I used to be a trial lawyer. I'm not thrilled about it, but I'll tell you what. You dangle tort reform in front of Republicans, and they follow you around like a hungry pack of dogs. You can get whatever you want. And for the person that hissed about it, come on. Would you really stop young children across America from having health care insurance just because you don't like tort reform? No, Americans will sacrifice. Americans will come together. But we have got a dysfunctional process where people like Governor Rendell and responsible Republicans can't go out and strike deals like that because jackasses on both sides, on both extremes, will savage them if they do. That's got to change, and that's our bigger responsibility. By the way, can I ask the governor, can you come up for a second? Can you come up for a second?
Come on up here, Governor.
And talk just for a second of that? Because I hope I didn't put a lot of words in your mouth there.
But, oh, no.
But I, as if anybody can put words into this guy's mouth. Oh, he goes to the podium.
He's so statesmanlike.
Hey, hold on.
Look at him.
Go over.
I'm the big bad governor. I get a podium. All right, no, but Governor, seriously, don't you think you could find a Republican in Washington, D.C., take him into a room, and put together a plan that progressives and conservatives could come together on?
Sure, and Joe's exactly right. The plan he etched out is, I think, a perfect compromise with one caveat: breaking down the barriers state by state on allowing insurance companies to come in and sell in every state is okay, as long as there are national standards. For example, in Pennsylvania, we require our insurance companies to provide services to autistic children and adults. We require a mandatory cervical cancer screening. Now, we're not ready to let a company from another state that doesn't do that come in and sell to our individuals because we've made a judgment of what's right. The way to get around that, and Governor Pawlenty suggested this, and I told Governor Pawlenty I'd support him, is create national standards and states sign on to national standards. And if the insurance company is willing to live up to
right.
those national standards, they can sell everything.
And you know what? Even if 20 of those states don't sign up, instead of competing in one state, two insurance companies, I'll take 30 states, right? So yeah, the bigger point though is something's happened in America. Something's happened in politics. What is it? Why can't this sort of compromise happen like it used to happen?
It changed somewhere around the beginning of the Clinton administration. Interestingly, when I was mayor of Philadelphia, five mayors went down to see Bob Dole. In the midst of the budget crisis when the government was in the process of being shut down. And Bob Dole said to us, and he said, if you repeat this publicly, I'll deny it. But it's been 17 years, so I think I can.
Oh, that's the statute of limitations on being honorable's run. Go ahead.
Bob
tell
Dole
the story.
Said, and you'd be interested in this. Bob Dole said, pointing a finger at Newt Gingrich and the ideologues, he said, if Bill Clinton and I got into a room together, we'd have a budget in 3 hours. It's exactly what Joe's talking about. But the problem is, and I blame politicians first, as I said in my opening remarks, media second. The problem is too few of us are willing to take a risk. Too few of us are willing to take a risk. There was a Time magazine cover about 10 years ago with George Washington, a tear going down his eye, and the subtitle was, with American politicians afraid to lead, the country falters. It's happening today.
And
is it worse today?
Yeah, it's worse today.
Why?
Because the pressure on politicians from the extremes has gotten so unbelievable.
Look at
Charlie Crist.
Right.
Tell
them
about
there
Charlie Crist.
I was just going to say, let's say there was a budget crisis in Pennsylvania. And let's say, I know there's not.
You know.
But let's just say there were. By the way, There's a budget crisis in every state in America. This is, and I've said this to the governor, just like I said it to John Corzine, a guy I really love, a good friend of ours in the show. This is the worst time, seriously, to be governor ever. It is a horrific time. But here's the problem, state by state by state and in Washington, D.C., if a Democratic governor in the middle of an impasse decided he wanted to show courage and reach out to a Republican, they would go, they would have a discussion, and by the end of that discussion, it would be on the Huffington Post. Governor Rendell sells out to moneyed interests. No, I'm dead serious. That's a problem with this health care bill, that every time Democrats come together and try to compromise with each other, not even Republicans, 2 seconds later, it's on Daily Kos or the Huffington Post, that they're sellouts, that they hate little children. The same thing happens on the other side. If a Republican decides to compromise with Barack Obama, the same thing happens. That is a serious problem. I'm not saying let's get rid of the Internet, let's censor the Internet. I'm not saying that. I'm just, if you want to know what the biggest problem is, I think that's one of the great problems today, that compromise is seen as weakness. And in this environment, if you disagree with somebody, they're not wrong, they're evil. And we got to get past that. More questions, yes.
One more? Okay.
Yeah, I think what just happened, I think, was interesting because I really enjoy your guys' show a lot. And my question was getting back to Mika's book and the point that you guys had brought up earlier about, you know, women in the media. It seems that, I'm just thinking particularly about a clip I saw that was Jon Stewart talking about one of the women who was a Fox News anchor or something, and how after he had done research, he found out that she was, like, valedictorian of her class, but yet she, you know, was basically forced or, you know, like, coerced to come across as, you know, I guess less than intelligent, I would say, less than, you know, overtly intelligent. And I think that, you know, like, that happens a lot with the women commentators. They sort of get, I mean, the last 10 minutes, you know, this is, I guess it's Mika's book tour, but, you know, Joe and the governor got into a conversation, and, you know, the egos fly, you know?
I tried to leave. I mean, I tried to leave.
I asked him to come with me.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot on the show, and it kind of, you know, it bothers me a little bit sometimes.
Hold on.
Oh, shh. Hey. I'm going to sit down now.
Okay. Is there a question?
The question is, I mean, I have to be honest, I primarily watch MSNBC, and primarily for the women on it. I mean, I really like Rachel. I really like you. When I try to watch other networks, I, you know, just get frustrated with
right.
that point that I made. And I find it, you know, I'm just wondering, do you see a difference in the way that you're treated at MSNBC as a woman?
No, actually, well, that's a whole. There's a lot of answers to that question when you talk about how management in television treats women. But in terms of this show and my role, it's called Morning Joe. That's number one. Number two, and this is more important, my role is the newsreader, the journalist, the sometimes chiming in with liberal contrarian points of view or surprisingly conservative ones, depending on what the issue is. But it really is to help moderate the discussion because this voice is the best conservative voice there is, let alone on television. And the other conservative voices on television are somewhat caricatures. So what I do and what I am very proud of is helping frame it. Because he can take on three Democrats at our table, and my job, and is a lot of what you see off camera, is me telling them who gets the chance and moderating the discussion and allowing a good, strong, articulate, conservative voice to come out on television somewhere, and let alone somewhere on MSNBC, because there ain't one on MSNBC except this one.
But can I just say, it's awfully demeaning when you call me an articulate conservative man.
And so white.
I mean, that suggests that conservatives aren't usually articulate, and it's just very, very offensive to me. Can I just say also?
No, but hold on 1 second.
See, look, this is what it's really like. I was just about to say that, and Chris will tell
down.
You. And see,
She's really in charge. I swear to God. She tells us all what to do when the cameras are off. It's like that Saturday Night Live skit with Ronald Reagan where he's yelling at the staff after everybody leaves the room.
There is a certain degree of power that I use to help develop the show. But what I don't need is to show that to the world. I don't need to put myself out there as number one. I don't want to, and I'm very happy in a supportive role. That's what I do best. I'm not here to have my own show. I like the collaborative effort of me, Joe, and Willie, and I talk about that in the book. How this is, everyone wanted me to be the anchor of the CBS Evening News. Everyone wanted me to be a 60 Minutes correspondent. Everyone wanted me to be number one because I thought I was so talented. But really what I know I do best is actually something like this, where there's a voice that I know isn't heard out there in the media. The media is so liberal, okay? And I'm a liberal. I'm sort of happy about that, but I'm also sort of concerned about it. Because we need different worldviews. We need different voices in the media. We need to be honest about our worldview, our political affiliation. We need to be honest about who we are so we can be trusted. Okay? Because right now there's this sort of veil of objectivity in the mainstream media and then these extremes on cable. Come on. Come on. In the mainstream media, they're all Democrats. All of them. Okay? They all voted for Obama. That's not objective. And so there's a lot I do that has to do with what I'm talking about, but it has nothing to do with needing to get that last word in or being number one. That means nothing to me, and that doesn't get the job done at the end of the day, at least not this one.
Okay, can I speak for
no.
a second? Okay. So anyway, your question has elicited a response, and we've never told this. I don't think we've ever told this to anybody, and Mika probably doesn't want me to say it, but I don't have a filter. Early on, and I just figured that out. Early on in this process, whenever we would do topics, it would be me and usually most of the people we have on are progressives, Democrats, journalists with worldviews different than my own. And on certain topics, when we'd debate, and like for instance, Gitmo or the CIA, really impassioned topics where I always felt outnumbered, and sometimes I let my emotions. This is one of the few topics where I really let my emotions get the better of me. I would say to Mika, hey, I really need you to weigh in here because it just looks like I'm steamrolling over you. And I've said that several times, and Mika said something to me, and it's when I figured out just how much more brilliant she was than me. She said, you don't understand something about women and TV. Everybody emails me, and they say, we want you to fight back with Joe. We want you to punch back. We want you to... They say that, but they don't mean that. Because you do it, and we all have fun and make fun of you and laugh at you. And at the end of the day, you're just good old Joe. You're Fred Flintstone. When I do that, I'm a...
bitch.
Right. She said, so please, because there are a lot of times I would go off the set and I would actually be angry with her because she hadn't talked. I said, you're making me look bad. Fight back. Don't just sit there and smile or roll your eyes at the camera. And then she would roll her eyes at me. And then she would say, the rules are different for women than they are for men, Joe. And you're just going to have to trust me. I know TV a hell of a lot more than you.
And I take my moments when they're there. I do. But you do have to moderate them. Nobody really wants me screaming at the camera and beating the crap out of him. They don't. It may be fun once, maybe once a week. But
once an hour, once a segment,
really
once a minute.
And I know that is true. I mean, I truly believe that. I believe there is a certain taste and appetite that the audience has out there in America, and I have to work with that. But I'm not hampered by that. And if I have something to say, I'll say it. But I really am more concerned about making sure there is a strong conservative voice on our network that is balanced well with the other guests on, and sometimes that involves me, but it doesn't need to be me. And you know what? That lack of need, that lack of, like, I've got to be in there all the time, is the most liberating thing I've ever experienced. experienced, because I've always been coached to push, 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 forge ahead and be, you know, that strong woman that pushes herself out there to number one. It's just not me, but it's also not necessarily very attractive.
Every man that works on Morning Joe will tell you that Mika Brzezinski is the most remarkable person they've ever worked with in any field. And I hope after listening to her tonight that you agree with me. She really is extraordinary, and we're all lucky to know her. Everybody, big hand for Mika Brzezinski.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.